Tonight on the Daily Debrief in South Carolina, the frantic search for five missing children.
My heart dropped. They had disappeared. They had vanished.
This man is on trial for murder. This is what he told his neighbors.
He needed a fresh start, he and the kids, and they would not be returning.
Can the state secure a conviction, or is the defendant legally insane? And in Vermont.
He'd just go crazy and do something dramatic, correct?
Yes.
Did a defendant plan out a wrong-way crash which killed five teens and led to murder charges? Real-life cases are happening nationwide. This is the Daily Debrief for Wednesday, May 15th.
And good evening, everybody. Welcome to The Debrief. I'm Aaron Keller, along with Julie Rendleman, former prosecutor, current criminal defense attorney. Day two of a death penalty case in South Carolina. Timothy Jones Jr. admits to killing his five children, ages 1 through 8, and then driving around with their bodies for more than a week. Authorities say he strangled four of the kids and beat another one to death. Jones is arguing insanity. A jury of 10 women and 8 men will decide his fate, and that is before they withdraw the alternates. Two witnesses testified today that they tried to find the kids after all five went missing.
When the children did not come back to the program, what, if any, action did you take?
Okay, they were absent on the Friday, and then on the third day afterwards, the following week, on Tuesday, when they weren't there, all three of them had been absent for 3 days, and so it alarmed me, and I went to the administrative office, and I believe I told Ms. Reichard, the assistant principal, that they had not been at the Boys and Girls Club after school program for 3 days, all of them.
Having observed the defendant interact with his children on this day, August 28, 2014, did he ever appear to be afraid of his children?
No.
Having observed him interact with his children on all the previous days, did he ever appear to be afraid of his children?
No.
Based on your observations, did you have any reason to be concerned about the defendant's mental health or well-being?
No, I did not.
And if you did have concerns, would you have allowed the children to leave with him?
No.
I knew Mr. Jones, so I did get out. We walked to the front door and we knocked. There was no answer. It was very quiet.
Looking here at State's Exhibit 8. So you go up on the porch and knock on the door?
Yes, ma'am.
Could you hear any indication of anyone inside that residence?
No, ma'am. It was eerily quiet to know that five children lived there. It was obvious that no one was there.
And what was your response to that?
I became extremely concerned. My heart dropped because at that point, we had had absolutely no contact since that previous Thursday, and in my mind, they had disappeared. They had vanished.
That principal also said the defendant employed strange discipline procedures like making his kids tour a jail cell. A manager next testified that the defendant started to change, but that there were no red flags.
I noticed that he looked like he was definitely losing some weight. He had started smoking. He looked a bit tired, I think is the way I would phrase it. I kind of, maybe a little haggard, like he was, had a lot on his mind, a lot to do.
Knowing he was a single father of five, did that raise any red flags for
you? It did not.
As far as work, what, if any, did you notice?
Again, about that same time, I remember that, he was pretty diligent about on his on-time deliverables, and during that time, some of them started to slip. He still continued to do work. His work was still good, it's just that it was coming in later than expected. When he was there, he seemed distracted, that he was either thinking of something else, and I think attributed that somewhat to his family life.
Did you ever observe anything in him or in his behavior that caused you to be concerned marital status?
No.
A neighbor who also babysat for the Jones victims recalled a chilling conversation with the defendant after he and the kids went missing.
You're reminding him to bring diapers, and his response back to you is...
Busy, question mark, yeah.
Okay. What'd you say back?
I said, okay. I didn't quite understand what that meant, busy.
All right. What happened next, Miss Elfie?
He called. He said that he had left South Carolina, that he needed a fresh start, he and the kids, and they would not be returning. He said that he knew he owed me money and for babysitting, and that he had taken everything he needed from the home, and I was free to get whatever I needed out of the home to compensate for what he owed me. He mentioned the washer and dryer, his computer, things that I guess were of value, or he thought that I could sell to make the money back, I guess. And that was it.
Here is how the state kicked off its case.
Should be safe in a father's arms. It's a simple statement, and it's a true statement. But Tim Jones' five children were not safe in his arms. Mira Gracie Jones, 8 years old, murdered by her father, August 28, 2014. Elias Jones, her brother, 7 years old, murdered by his father with his hands. Natan Jones, 6 years old, killed at his father's hands, August 28, 2014. Gabriel Jones, 2 years old, killed at his father's hands, August 28, 2014. And the baby Abigail, 1 year old, murdered by her father. Saturday, September 6, 2014, at about 9 o'clock, Tim Jones, driving his Escalade, is stopped at a traffic safety checkpoint in Smith County, Mississippi. He is arrested for driving under the influence and possession of synthetic cannabinoids. The children are not with him, and the car smells like death. He's taken into custody, and over the course of a few days, he's interviewed, and ultimately, he leads the police to the bodies of his children. Each one wrapped in a garbage bag on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere.
The defense used an analogy about a forest and trees to draw jurors into its insanity defense.
I've got a friend who works at the Forestry Commission. He always says, you can't judge the health of a forest by only looking at a few trees. That is what the state is going to ask you to do in this trial, is to just look at a few trees. They're not going to ask you to look at the seeds that the forest was planted with. They're not going to ask you to test the soil to see if the foundation of that forest is poor. You heard the judge say that Tim has pled not guilty by reason of insanity. That was not a defense that Tim picked out, like when you were in voir dire and the judge read you a list of defenses. That is a defense that the lawyers, in consultation with experts, a full examination of Tim and a review of his family history. Tim has schizophrenia, something he wasn't diagnosed with prior to his arrest. Tim's mind is broken. In deciding whether Tim knew the legal or moral right from wrong, you need to look at the full forest, not just a few trees.
Joining me tonight is attorney Julie Rendleman, former prosecutor, current criminal defense attorney. So, Julie, the defense tactic here is to point in part to this family history, and we have heard subsequent testimony say that there are mental health issues on both sides of the family. Is that really going to help in this case?
The defense is stuck with what they have, which is five dead children. And I don't think strong evidence that he was so mentally ill at the time that these children were killed that he's not going to be responsible. So he's working with what he has. Who knows until the defense experts take the stand as to how well they'll do.
We'll have to see. Okay, so what evidence do we have to prove that this defendant was indeed sane at the time he killed these kids?
Well, I mean, I think one of the biggest things that the prosecution has is his behavior afterwards and his behavior in efforts to clean up what he had done and to cover his tracks. What he said to his neighbor in terms of, you know, that I'm going to be away, I'll be away till Tuesday, evidence of him cleaning up, evidence of him putting the kids in blankets and getting rid of the bodies. These are all things that the prosecution is going to point to and say he had the complete wherewithal to not only kill these kids, but figure out a way to get rid of them. That indicates someone who knows what they're doing.
The bleach in the car as well. I mean, that's a big one for the state. In this case. Oh, this whole line of evidence that they have, to me, I think adds up for a stronger state case than a defense case, but I'm willing to wait and see.
Look, time will tell, but I'm confident that the defense recognizes, if we're sitting in the defense chair, that they have an uphill battle and recognize that, but want to get ahead of it if there is, in fact, a death penalty stage.
Certainly. Julie Rendleman arguing both sides of the case tonight for us here on The Debrief. And still ahead tonight, the case of Horror on the Highway out of Vermont. Yet another expert tries to convince the jury defendant was legally insane, but wait until you hear the threats he was making about going on a rampage long before he drove the wrong way down the highway and killed five teens. We discuss after the break. A couple of other stories we're following tonight before we head back to court. An assistant coach at the University of Southern California pleaded guilty in connection with a college cheating scandal. Laura Janke pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit racketeering. Prosecutors say she has been helping their investigation. Janke admitted to accepting payments to a private soccer club of hers in return for helping make fake athletic profiles for students. Sentencing in her case will occur in October. A pioneer of criminal profiling is out with a new book. The Killer Across the Table dives into the minds of serial killers. Its author is a former FBI special agent who spoke with the Law and Crime Network today about how some serial killers start their killing sprees.
It starts off as fantasy. With most of them, it begins with fantasy, maybe fantasy fueled by pornography or now the internet, the stuff on the internet. But eventually, even like when I interview like Dennis Rader, the BTK strangler, a lot began with drawings and a bondage and discipline, and also where he could hold a woman captive for a period of time, and he would draw a like torture, torture chambers, with these. With these women, but it is eventually the fantasy no longer becomes satisfying for them, so they decide to act out. In the case of McGowan, when he said when he heard the door, I looked up and heard this knocking at the screen door. He said, "John, I knew I was going to kill her." The fascinating part about the interview is that I did the interview in a very low lighting. I wanted darkness. I found over the years, if I can do a nighttime interview, I'll prefer to do a nighttime interview. Low lighting, very little furniture, no cuffs on, no leg irons, mm-hmm. and bring them in the room, but I don't want you, corrections, to interrupt this interaction I'm going to have. And what happens is, it takes a while, but I want to try to turn on the CD in the brain to take him back to the crime that he perpetrated 30 years ago. And he said, "When I heard the knock on the screen door, I knew I was going to kill her." He talks about how he sexually assaulted her. He tells me about how difficult it was to manually strangle to kill her. It's a lot harder, John, than it is in the movies.
And now back to the case of Horror on the Highway. A Vermont man accused of murdering five high school students. Stephen Burgoyne is facing five counts of second-degree murder, one count of aggravated operation of a vehicle, and one count of gross negligence. This police reconstruction video shows how authorities believe Burgoyne sped down the interstate in the wrong lane, then swerved to the left and slammed head-on into a vehicle carrying five high school friends. None of the victims of that crash survived. One died at age 15 right there at the scene. The others were 16. After the first crash, Burgoyne stole a responding police car, took off, turned around, and then caused a second massive, fiery crash.
Now we got a person trapped in the car. Pull the fire extinguisher. Who's got my car?
Police officer.
That is just a small piece of the squad car footage, which shows Burgoyne taking off in the police SUV after the first crash. He eventually turned it around, did a full three-point turn, and drove back into the previous wreckage at 103 miles per hour. Testifying last week was Burgoyne's ex-girlfriend and the mother of his daughter. Anila Lawrence covered her face just after taking her oath and appeared to be uncontrollably shaking on the witness stand. She described an instance where Burgoyne took off with her and their baby in the back of his car and threatened to crash into a pond if she did not agree to 50-50 custody of the child. A bombshell moment today came from a defense psychiatrist who originally examined this case for the state. She said the defendant had paranoid personality disorder, feared a conspiracy against him, feared people were harassing him, and then this.
The transient stress-related paranoid ideation and dissociative symptoms. And so that's essentially what I think happened around the time of the crime, is that he was under a tremendous amount of stress related to financial problems and his custody arrangement with his daughter, and that those stressors then triggered a psychotic episode, including paranoid ideation, around the time of the crime.
So that's part of this expert's diagnosis, but then there's also this. The expert admitted that Burgoyne threatened to go crazy if he lost custody of his child.
Did admit to talking to his brother about having despair and sadness and depression and vocalizing that he had nothing left to live for, though, correct?
Yes.
And further, he told you that he was referring to the fact that his career had fallen apart, his relationship had fallen apart, his finances were about to be lost, and everything going on with my daughter, there wasn't anything I could point to and say, well, I have this going for me. Do you recall that quote?
Yeah, it was definitely a period of hopelessness for him.
And you further confronted him on previous thoughts of suicide because you had reviewed an interview and a deposition with one of his best friends, Asima Kosovic. Is that correct?
Yes, he had told her, well, she had said to the police, he had said something along the lines of, you know, she thought jokingly, but I might as well shoot everybody up or kill myself, something like that.
Specifically, he told Ms. Kosovic a couple of months before the crashes that if he loses his daughter, he was going to go off the deep end, and said something about getting a rifle and going around shooting everyone in sight.
Yes, and she thought he was joking at the time.
He also told her that he'd just go crazy and do something dramatic, correct?
Yes.
Keep in mind that psychiatrist was being cross-examined by the prosecution who originally hired that psychiatrist. She was one of three psychiatrists who identified, or rather examined, the defendant. Here's the opinion of another one.
Based on those examinations, you believe that Mr. Burgoyne has borderline personality. Is that correct?
That's my opinion, yeah.
Okay. And I believe you stated in your report that could mimic bipolar disorder, but it is your opinion that Mr. Burgoyne does not have bipolar disorder, correct?
So the testing did not show bipolar disorder. However, in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, under both bipolar and borderline personality, it says that both could occur.
Right. But it's your opinion is that he does not have borderline personality.
So the testing didn't show that, and my opinion is that it's not inconsistent, but that's not what I found.
Okay. And
With regards to borderline personality disorder, you mentioned that somebody can become psychotic in the presence of emotional discontrol. I think those were your words. Is that correct? But that someone with borderline personality disorder can also become rageful and disinhibited, correct?
Correct.
Earlier in the case, we heard testimony about Burgoyne being in the wrong place in a hospital, possibly seeking treatment, but also saying things that didn't quite make sense to a nurse. That nurse called security, and here is what security testified to as to their interaction with Burgoyne. Keep in mind, what's disturbing here is that this interaction may have resulted in Burgoyne not receiving treatment before the crash.
I was walking in that back hallway. I was approached by an RN in the emergency department.
You remember who?
I do.
Who's that?
Margie McLaren.
Okay. She was just in court just a minute ago? Okay. And what did she say to you?
There's a gentleman hanging out in the executive hallway.
So what did you do?
I went through those doors I had mentioned and encountered the individual at the end of the executive hallway. Okay.
Did you later figure out that that person was Stephen Burgoyne?
Later, yes.
Okay. And so tell me what happened.
So he was standing in the hallway reading something on the wall. I don't remember exactly what. I approached him from behind, introduced myself, explained to him he couldn't be hanging out in that part of the hallway. He turned headwise and just, "I'm sorry, I'll just leave," and he walked down the hallway.
Okay, for analysis on this case, Julie Rendleman is back with me now. So Julie, look, this statement by the defendant that he would go crazy, shoot people if he lost custody of his daughter, is that enough to sink this case for the defense?
I think it's a big problem for the defense because it certainly, look, you talk about premeditation earlier. I mean, this is someone who is discussing, even though the doctor says that the person didn't believe or thought it was a joke, it came to fruition. Of course not. And so, yes, I think it's a big, big problem. However, this case, different than some of the other cases we've heard, seems to have a lot of pieces of serious mental illness that at least existed right before the incident happened.
Okay, yes, and Vermont has a pretty low burden of proof for the defense to put that evidence up. It's preponderance of the evidence. The legal standard is rather open. So if one little grain of sand convinces the jury that there are mental health issues here, then this is a not guilty by reason of insanity, and it's a commitment to a mental hospital. But let me ask about something else. Dr. Kapoor, she was originally a state witness. She didn't write a report for the state. Did the state cure that by saying, we just didn't want to waste taxpayer money to have you prepare it?
No, I think if I were a juror, I'd be very bothered by that. At the end of the day, not every doctor does write a report, especially when you're not going to use that doctor. But in front of a jury, they're going to be bothered by it because they're going to think, what did they have to hide?
Exactly. Julie Rendleman, thanks a lot for your opinions tonight. I appreciate them. I'm sure everybody else does as well. We'll see you back here tomorrow at 5 p.m. for the Daily Debrief. Have a good evening, everyone.